Hello and welcome to episode 9 of the Risk Test podcast with me, Shaf Chowdhury, and, well, you're probably wondering where Sadia is. Now, Sadia's travelling with work, so you're going to have to make do with me flying solo. Not only am I flying solo, but I'm recovering from man flu, so, you know, man down, you'll never understand how bad it is, etc, etc. Now, we always start with a review or a recap of the previous episode of the podcast. And we were really lucky to have Tez Ilyas, who joined us in our studio. When I'm saying studio, it was a room with a mic in. But he joined us for a chat and a cup of tea. And he was really honest and open about sharing some of his experiences about how he got into comedy in the first place, some of his experiences along the way, how he really kind of combined his comedy with his identity, and some of the work that he's doing with Guz Khan on Man Like Mubeen, which has been renewed for a new season, which is really great because it's absolutely hilarious. One of the best things about running this podcast is the feedback that we receive. Now, when you send an email in or a DM or you mention us on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram, we really do read every single one. And it does shape how we run the podcast because we want to do better. And if there are things that work, let us know. If there are things that don't work, please do let us know. Because honestly, we want to make this as good as it possibly can be. And we want to make you a part of that. Now, because Sadia's not here, I'm going to roll around in data a little bit. Because that's what I do. So, since we launched the podcast, it was very UK focused. And even the people who listen to it, primarily in the UK. Now, that listenership has kind of grown to 26 countries now. So we are listened to in 26 countries around the world. Now, of that 26 countries, still the majority, I would say 60%, is the UK. But 24% of that is in the US, the United States, which is great. So I always like to peel back the layers of the onion when it comes to data and understand, well, what's underneath that. So I had a quick look in that 24%. And by far, the biggest geographic location within the US is California that listen to our podcast. So 60% of the US listenership is in California. Yet we have some great stats from New York, Michigan, Illinois, Maryland, Arizona, etc., etc. But I really wanted to dive into the California stat. And in California, the biggest city that listen to our podcast in California is Los Angeles, LA, which is great because that's where Hollywood is. A lot of the, it's like the center of all this, the kind of the showbiz world, which is great. So if you are listening in LA, please do drop us a tweet or send us an email. Well, wherever you're from, really. But I'm just so deep in this data. The second city on that list in California is Mountain View. Now, I hear you ask, what's Mountain View? What's so good about Mountain View? And I'll tell you what's good about Mountain View. It's Google are based in Mountain View. Now, that 5% of the listeners in California who listen to us from Mountain View, now that has to be the same people, the same 4% of our listeners, of our entire listenership, who use the Google Podcast app to listen to us using the Google Podcast app in Mountain View, in the US, because I'll be honest, I don't know anyone else who uses the Google Podcast app. Now, that's not a dig, I'm just saying. Anyway, moving on. Today's guest, we've had so much support from our guest this week. One of the best things about, again, one of the best things about running this podcast is meeting interesting people, amazing people who support us and support our work and all of those things. Now, Nina Bhagwat, who I interviewed earlier this year, she was one of the earliest supporters of the Risk Test. And she got in touch with us via Twitter early days. And she's been really great in not only in terms of really giving us an insight into the industry, in the TV industry, and the state of BAME, B-A-M-E, representation, but she's been wonderful in terms of introducing us to other people. She's invited me down for a couple of events down at Channel 4 when she worked there, and it's been really great for me to kind of expand my network. Now, a little bit about Nina. Now, Nina, most recently, has been working as the off-screen diversity executive at Channel 4. Now, we'll go into off-screen diversity in a minute when we're on, in the conversation with Nina. But recently, she's moved on to become the head of inclusion and diversity at the Warner Music Group, which is great because she's done so many amazing things at Channel 4. She's set up so many initiatives, and now she's going off to the Warner Music Group to expand what she's doing in the music world, which is great. Now, I'm going to have to apologize for the quality of the recording with Nina, because I went out and bought a really fancy podcasting mic. It was not that fancy, and if you're interested to know, it's the Blue Yeti. And I configured it, got it all working, and I went down to meet Nina, and I made a really schoolboy error and select it as the input source. And, you know, it's the kind of mistake that you only make once, but I made it twice. But hey, we'll go into that another time. So let's hear what Nina's got to say. I'm joined by Nina Bhagwat. Did I pronounce that correctly?
That was very good. Better than me, actually.
Really?
Better than my pronunciation.
I'm going to leave you to introduce yourself because you've done so many things, and I don't think I'd do you justice.
Okay, so I guess my background is in the TV industry. You know, since I left university, that's the industry I've worked in. I started off working in off-screen roles, so as a researcher, and then I became a documentary director, and then I had my son, and I kind of realised that actually it's not that practical being a freelancer and having kids. So really, you know, not that it was planning, I was really fortunate. I got the opportunity to work in a talent agency for off-screen production people, so I kind of moved from a production role into a talent and training and then diversity facing role. So really, for the second part of my career, for the last 12-13 years, really, I've been focusing on talent and developing talent, and particularly around the whole diversity and inclusion space now.
And what part of your career do you enjoy most? Is it the production side of things, or what you've been doing in phase two?
That's really hard, because I think I loved working in production, and that's actually it's a strange thing, because that's in many ways what I feel I should still be doing, really. On one level. On the other hand, I found something that I'm working within that is I'm so completely aligned with, I'm so sort of committed to, I'm passionate about. Mm-hmm. So I've really, it's a bit of a blessing, really. Sometimes your career takes what you think is a downward turn, but actually it's in those spaces that you really get the opportunities to do something different and grow.
No, absolutely. And I guess the first, all your experience prior to having your son, that's put you in an amazing position, because you're informed, you know, you're uniquely positioned to do the role that you're doing now, right? You're a natural networker, because that's how we met in the first place, right?
Yeah, I don't know about natural. I think I've had to make myself be a networker, because actually, I'm probably quite introvert. I'm probably quite pipe and slippers, actually.
Right.
But you can't be pipe and slippers in this industry. Mm-hmm. So I've found a way of doing that I feel comfortable with. Mm-hmm. And actually, what I do have is a complete curiosity about people. Mm-hmm. And different people from, you know, all manner of backgrounds and with all kinds of experiences. So that actually, I think, is the thing that makes me happy to network and talk to people.
Yeah.
So yeah.
So that's when we first met, when you reached out on Twitter, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, how did you first hear about the RIS test? I mean, I guess in your role, you have to have your ear to the ground anyway, right? To hear what's going on. I mean, how did you come across the work that we do?
I think I must have seen you on Twitter, mm-hmm. actually. And I think it was actually probably because I was following Riz.
Right.
And then, obviously, I think Riz followed you. And I'm a huge fan of Riz as a talent, but actually really watch with interest what he does with his talent and what he does with the platform he now has.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I found the wrist test.
That's great to hear, actually, because some people have heard it through word of mouth, but you heard it from Riz endorsing us in on Twitter, which is fantastic. I'm very nature of the wrist test. We named it after Riz because of his sensibilities. It wasn't just because he did his speech at the House of Commons. He's been saying the same thing for many, many years, as many of us have.
His writing is fantastic. Mm-hmm. I mean, his writing, like the piece he wrote for the Good Immigrant, everyone's read.
Mm-hmm.
I find his writing extraordinary. And actually, mm-hmm. Because I was working at Channel 4 when he gave his speech in Parliament, I was in the audience. And he's extraordinary because he delivered that in the most powerful and authentic way. And what an interesting thing to do with the privileged position he now occupies.
Yeah.
What an interesting thing to do.
Definitely, and I think it's great that you were there in the audience. That's fantastic. One of the questions that I have is, with the RIS test, we were initially looking at how Muslims were represented on screen in terms of the characters and all of that. And once we had spoken to people like yourself and others, off screen is a huge deal as well. How would you describe the difference in off screen and on screen? And do you think potentially off screen has a larger impact?
I think that I'm talking through the narrow lens of telly, which is quite a narrow lens, particularly now. I think predominantly the focus has gone on screen, right? Because in many ways, it's an easier thing to fix, right? However, I think we're now in a space where audiences can sniff out inauthentic storytelling. And the real issue, what has most impact and what is most important to address, but from my perspective, is off-screen representation. And that's off-screen representation in key creative roles. Because unless it's the people who have the editorial say-so, who make those decisions, who hold the money, who make the decisions about writers, unless those people represent the world as the world looks, rather than it representing a very narrow portion of the population,
mm-hmm.
I think you're going to get inauthentic storytelling. And I think, I certainly feel that audiences now are so much more savvy. When I was growing up, there were, BBC One, BBC Two, ITV.
Right.
So, when Mind Your Language came on...
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Right, I am that old. When Mind Your Language came on, and it's such a cliche, but literally all of the family would be around the TV set and we would be glued to it, even mm-hmm. though it perpetuated some real, utterly grotesque stereotypes. It was the only brown and black people... they were the only brown and black people on telly. So,
mm-hmm.
of course, we were just sort of transfixed. However, now I have more choice as to where to take my viewing.
Yeah.
And, young audiences, that demographic, they're becoming more diverse, that part of the population.
Mm-hmm.
I think audiences want real, proper, authentic storytelling. And you can only get to that if the storytellers are diverse. I mean, across all of the strands of diversity. So off screen really matters.
So in many ways, if we don't get off screen right, then on screen is the symptom, just like a plaster on a deeper wound or problem, right?
Well, I think actually Lenny Henry put it really well. This was a couple of years ago. He made a speech again at Parliament. It's like a recurring theme, isn't it? He made a speech where he referred to Milli Vanilli diversity.
Yeah.
And what I think he meant by that was sort of on screen, you have the impression of diversity because it's the numbers,
the
numbers.
The quota.
Exactly. Yeah. But he really made the point that actually the off screen had not changed at all. And sometimes when you turn on the TV, you feel like, wow, that looks like really, that looks like the real world, that looks really diverse, but actually the people who are making those programs don't reflect that.
That's really interesting. And on that note, actually, is off-screen diverse? Has it got better? Is where are we with that? Are we nearly there, or are we?
Right. So what we really need in this is brilliant data to be able to conclusively say this is where we are. The dial has been moved in this direction or the other direction. Hopefully not. However, we're not at the, you know, we're beginning to gather for the TV industry, gathering information via Diamond, which will show us who's on telly and who's making telly. However, until that data set increases and gets to a point where it can really give us the full picture, I can talk about what I instinctively think is happening.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's become harder to survive in this industry for everyone,
mm-hmm.
you know, across all, you know, whoever you are, whether you have a point of difference or not,
mm-hmm.
because contracts are much shorter.
Right.
It's incredibly competitive.
And why has it become more competitive? Is that the threat from like Netflix?
Or? Well, I think the industry for people working in production has always been competitive.
Okay.
I don't quite think it's the destination that it used to be, because when, you know, for example, when I was entering TV, there were only a few ways you could have a creative career. Whereas now, for like my kids, there'll be like 100 different ways they can be creative.
Yeah. Look at this. Even look at Strictly Come Dancing. There was a YouTuber on Strictly Come Dancing.
I mean, I think what when I say that, you know, talking about data, there is an interesting set of data which is from Directors UK, which obviously is just focused on the role of directors.
Yeah.
So I think 3 or 4 years ago they did a piece of research on gender,
mm-hmm.
called "Who's Calling the Shots,"
right.
and on BAME representation, which was called "Adjusting the Colour Balance," and they kind of, you know, it was a fairly depressing read on both fronts in terms of the representation of women and then BAME talent,
mm-hmm.
in the role of directors. And then they reviewed that work. They did an update, I think would have been in 2018. And actually that demonstrated that things had got slightly worse.
Wow.
In both cases.
Yeah.
So there's a huge amount of work to be done still in these roles, and I think, you know, obviously the role of director is so key in this, because that's who's telling the story, right? It's who owns these stories,
yes.
and who has the right to tell these stories.
Mm-hmm.
And our talent, be it women, be it disabled talent, be it BME talent, mm-hmm. you know, different socioeconomic backgrounds,
mm-hmm.
are we able to tell our stories in an authentic way without someone filtering that?
I understand. So is that because there aren't enough storytellers and directors and talent from those communities and socioeconomic groups, or is it that they're just not getting past the decision makers?
I think it's sort of twofold. The talent are out there.
Mm-hmm.
The talent are absolutely out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's about who gets the opportunity to thrive and progress, right? And it's an industry that hires through known networks. Because of the nature of the industry, you know, you might be looking for someone in 2 weeks' time or next week,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's natural in that respect that you're going to go with someone who you trust, and that's probably going to be someone who you know,
mm-hmm.
and that's probably going to be someone who you know because they're like, you have a bit of an affinity with them, it's more than likely to be someone who's kind of like you.
Yeah.
Now, that would be okay if we had representation, in those roles, those key hirers were incredibly diverse, because they'd be hiring diversely, right?
Absolutely.
But we don't have that. So it means that certain people get the opportunities and the breaks and are able to land in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's something, particularly with the role of directors, there's a whole set of associated perceptions around what a director looks like, sounds like, how they present, you know, how confident they are, the way they exhibit their leadership. So is it a very masculine form of leadership, you know? So there are all sorts of perceptions that the hirers and biases that the hirers hold, I mean, we all have biases, let's be honest about that, but that will mean they're making certain decisions around the directors who they meet.
How quickly is the industry moving to a place where there is better representation? Are we in a better position? Are you in a better position now than when you first started your career?
So is there more representation in those editorial roles?
Yeah.
Than when I started? I would say we're probably in a similar place.
Oh, wow. Right.
And possibly worse, going on the DUK data for directors.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in part that's to do with the fact that the industry is much, much tougher now than when I started.
Yeah. So what can be done then? I mean,
but there are changes. Right. There are changes, okay? So the interesting thing is what's happened with disruption, right? So if you look at the Netflixes, if you look at the way, I think the market recognises the value of diversity, right? Creatively and in terms of what your audience looks like and its global audiences, right? So I think there is now a, you know, there are diverse talent, A-list talent, who will be sucked up both on screen and off screen by those organisations who are able to offer them a different way of working, a more empowered way of working, perhaps. A financially better way of working, a way of having more agency in terms of storytelling. And that is good for diverse talent.
That's interesting you mentioned agency, because what we've found since launching the Risk Test project is that a number of directors and emerging, you know, talent in the space have messaged us privately and who wish to remain anonymous, and they've messaged us on Twitter or on an email, and they've said, look, we love what you're doing because A, it's a great idea, it highlights the problem in a, you know, in a kind of from external to the industry perspective, and you're saying the thing that we can't, because we can't be seen to be seen too much as, you know, too disruptive. Acceptably disruptive is fine, but then being too disruptive, it does jeopardize your own career.
Yeah, well, I have this phrase. So actually, I think part of my, so I work in diversity and inclusion. So I firmly believe that it is my job. It's about change, and it's about disrupting, and it's about having honest conversations. And those honest conversations are often quite uncomfortable. That's my job. That's what I should be. That's what I should be doing. So I have this phrase. Actually, I don't know whether it was mine. I've probably stolen it from someone. But it, there's something about being acceptably brown. Right. And I think that probably applies to being acceptably disruptive. And I think if you're in this space, It's my job to be honest about this. And I think it's really tough for actors and directors to tell their stories, as in, you know, the actual films they're making, but actually to tell the story of what it's like existing in this industry when often you are othered. That's really hard to exist in that space. And I think, again, going back to not wishing to fangirl it too much, but going back to some of the things Riz has said on this, talking about the noose around his neck and loosening that. And his success and his status has enabled him to do that. Okay, but when you, I mean, there are very few Rizzes and Idrises, aren't there?
Very few,
So most of us on screen and off screen are hustling and they're trying to make a living, So we, you know, we have to straddle that difficult thing of being true and honest and authentic and telling it as it is. But of course we need to stay in work, don't we? So it's really tough. Very hard, really tough.
Yeah, ultimately, a number of people have said to us, with regard to the risk test, where do you hold the actors accountable? I'm thinking, absolutely not, right? Because ultimately, you need to get a job, you need to earn money, you need to pay the rent, you need to eat. And interestingly enough, again, I get accused of fanboying Riz too much, but, you know, I don't mind, actually. He's a cool guy. He's some of his earlier films, a lot of people have said, well, some of his earlier work, especially that Road to Guantanamo and that kind of thing, that fails the Riz test. And you know, probably does. And, you know, and one thing that everyone asks is, where do you see Four Lions? Is that a pass or a fail? And we've had a number of arguments, both sides, you know, it doesn't, it passes because it's satire, but then it fails because it represents Muslims as terrorists. But the interesting thing is that, as you've just mentioned, Riz has been able to use his platform because he has the platform. Changing gear a little bit, with regard to some of the initiatives that you've seen in the industry, what do you see, or what approach do you see that worked particularly well?
So some of the projects I've worked on at Channel 4, I think, have delivered impact. And I think what we need to be focused on is impact rather than outcome. So outcome being, oh, we work with 60 people on this. Like,
yeah.
Impact being that person has moved on to this and now, you know.
It's a long-term thing.
Yeah,
it's a long-term.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the things I'm most proud of at Channel 4 are the interventions we've made in partnership with production companies and with talent, where we've been able to move talent through to the next level of their career,
yeah,
to the point where they are the decision makers.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's, for me, my preoccupation now is the middle, because I think initiatives are focused either on entry level or at the very, very senior level, right? And you need to get senior representation in order to make this transformative and sustainable, and to ensure that people like me are made redundant, frankly, and we don't need to be, you know...
We don't want that.
We don't have to be keep running all of these initiatives, right? But you're never going to get to that transformative point unless you have that talent pool in the middle who are moving up.
Mm-hmm.
And because we haven't, as an industry, and actually it's wider than TV, it's all industries struggle with this bit of the pipeline, I think,
mm-hmm,
particularly with the BAME agenda, is the frozen middle.
Yeah.
So talent only get to a certain point within organisations and then they find they can't progress up, so they leave and have to start somewhere else. So you have this thing which I don't know whether I've coined the phrase. I call it the BAME drain, basically.
Well, I like that, and I'm going to attribute it to you. So that sounds like the BAME drain. That's good.
And I think the more we focus on this frozen middle,
mm-hmm,
the better. And sort of with that in mind, myself and a number of like-minded individuals who work across the sector and across different organisations with the TV industry have got together and we've set up a Creative Industries Alliance, which is focusing on this frozen middle,
mm-hmm,
through a BAME lens, basically. And I think a rebalancing of resource towards working with this talent pool will get us closer to that point of transformative change.
Mm-hmm. What other organisations other than the Risk Test have you worked with? I know that's Legally Black that you introduced us to.
Yeah, I introduced you to Legally, yeah, Black, and then actually they came into Channel 4 and they did something for us on for Black History
Month. Brilliant.
So they're brilliant posters,
mm-hmm,
which were all over London.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's extraordinary because they're all really, I mean, as far from my standpoint, they're all really young.
Well, from my perspective as well, don't worry. I mean, they're actually university students, aren't they? They're really young.
And the posters they produced were amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
So they came in and did a similar thing for at Channel 4, actually,
mm-hmm,
which was great. But they're really engaged and active and,
mm-hmm,
proactive and all of the things I really wish I was when I was 18.
And one last thing to end on is I always bring up Bodyguard as an example of, to put it frankly, like, you know, really crap representation. Clearly no one on the production staff spoke to anyone. in a kind of an authentic way, because it fails all, the key statistic with Bodyguard is, it fails all five criteria of the risk test within the first 12 minutes of the first episode. And it's wildly, wildly popular. It's been sold, the rights have been sold to Netflix. And you don't have to answer this question, by the way. What horror stories or really bad, poor examples have you seen out there?
Wow. Loads, right. If I'm really honest. I'll go back to the Bodyguard, though.
Yeah.
Because what is interesting about this, and this is, I think, what the value is of the RIS test, mm-hmm. because this is a conversation that needs to be exploded,
yeah.
right? And we need to be having this debate and this conversation. When I watched it, I was really shocked. Mm-hmm. I was really shocked because I love his writing. I love his writing.
Mm-hmm. Jeff Mercurio, right?
I think the way previously he had dealt with difference, you know, whether that's gender, ethnicity, religion, you know, I just felt he was adept, like brilliant,
mm-hmm.
like a brilliant exemplar. And I was really shocked and dismayed when I watched it. The interesting thing is, though, is the number of conversations I've had about it subsequently. And I think it has exploded this whole conversation around
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
So as unfortunate as I think it is in many respects, because now that's going to be shown all around the world. And it's really problematic on a number of levels. I think we need to be having the conversation around this. There isn't going to be consensus around representation and who. No one owns authentic representation, right?
Yeah, 100%.
But if we have 150 different versions of what a Muslim is, or what an Asian woman is, or what a mixed, you know, race relationship looks like, or, you know, if we have 150 and more versions of what that looks like, that's diversity in our nirvana.
Yeah.
And where we are at the moment is we've just got everything through this singular lens.
Mm-hmm. That's a really interesting way of putting it. To end, then, we do have a feature that we ask all interviewees called Woke or Joke.
Yeah.
And what we ask is, what have you come across that you think is great, like really woke, really great initiative, something that you've seen? It could be anything, really. And something that you've seen recently, you think, actually, that's a bit of a joke, other than Bodyguard.
So, woke. So I would say, I'm going to talk about stuff that I love watching. So I think Russian Doll.
Ah, yes.
Just in terms of the way they do that on-screen diversity.
Mm-hmm.
Where it enhances the storytelling, but it's not beating anyone around the head with the...
It's not tokenism. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it's brilliant. It's brilliant. Anything by Jill Soloway, I love. Because I just instinctively respond to that as a viewer, because I feel I never see women in that way.
Yeah,
I never see women's stories being told in that way. Joke. Now, that is a tough one. I think I'm just going to say what I think is a joke. I think if the industry thinks they've got there in terms of authentic representation, if the industry think they can do authentic representation on screen without having it behind the camera and without relinquishing some of that control and giving it to people who are different, whatever that point of difference is, I think that's a joke.
That's brilliant. Nina, you've been very generous with your time. And so thank you very much for meeting with me. And also thank you very much for being an ally for the RIS test and reaching out in the first place. How can people get keep in touch with you? Are you on Twitter?
Yes, I'm on Twitter. And actually, I should say, having spent the whole of my career in the TV industry, I'm now having a change and I'm going to be working in inclusion and diversity, but for the music industry.
Oh, fantastic.
So I will be with Warner Music. So you can find me on Twitter.
But Nina, I wish you every success for the future. I'm sure you'll do really, really well. And I'm looking forward to catching up once you settle into the new role.
Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed.
Great.
As you can tell, Nina is incredibly knowledgeable about the industry and the state of representation in the industry. Not only that, she's incredibly networked. She knows literally everyone. And she's incredibly humble to top it off, which is wonderful. And as she mentioned in the conversation, she's now co-launching this Creative Industries Alliance. Now, I'll put the link to the website in the show notes, but be sure that once that launches, we're going to have another chat with her and catch up with what she's been doing at Warner Music and how she's getting on. Now, as ever, please do get in touch with us on email, that's hello@risktest.com. Follow us on Facebook, on Twitter, The Risk Test. You'll find us on Instagram at The Risk Test. And let us know your thoughts. Now, we've got some really great guests coming up in the next few weeks, and we can't wait for you to hear them all. And also, hopefully next time, Sadia will be back, so it'll be less of me ranting and talking about percentages and stats and going down little rabbit holes. Until then, I'll see you soon.